A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
You know, I really wish that we weren't here talking about impeachment. I wish that we were here to talk about this great nation and some of the interesting challenges that we have, some of the things that we just knew that our enlightened president was going to guide us and mold us and really lead us on, and that the representatives that we entrusted with our vote. That's exactly what you do. When you elect a senator or a representative, you are entrusting them to act on your behalf and go back to Washington and not only merely mirror, we've used that term a lot, mirror your view, but to really look for themselves. We're looking for people that we have admiration for, that we trust, that have some real common sense, some real goodness in their hearts and in their souls, and they will go back there. Yes, they will listen to us. Often they will reflect us. But occasionally, and this is where the book came from, there will be a profile in courage where that individual just goes, you know what? I'm just seeing it a little differently back here. And yes, I'm responsible to the folks back home. But more than anything, I'm responsible to the overall good of the nation. And yes, I represent the fill-in-the-blank district in Utah, or if you're a senator, the state of Utah. But my ultimate responsibility is to defend and protect this great nation through its great constitution. And I wish we were talking about all the great things that were happening from individuals just like I described. I wish we were talking about some of those amazing challenges that we have, where there really are some interesting and legitimate differences of opinion. And then classically in this great nation, we come together through the blessing of compromise. I'm not talking about selling your soul. I'm talking about principled compromise, realizing that the person with a differing opinion is also a great American, also wants to maintain the credibility and the goodness of this great nation, but they have a little different point of view on what it should be. And sometimes it's even a radical point of view. And often we can meet somewhat in the middle. And it moves this great nation forward, makes us a more perfect union. And then the Supreme Court, if there was something that wasn't being able to be wrangled out among our legislators, or there was arguments over the law, then they would so wisely and impartially, realizing that, hey, the executive, they are doing their job. The legislature is doing its job. We do not have to legislate from the bench. All we have to do is determine whether or not, in our impartiality, that this is indeed constitutional or not. I wish we were talking about that, but we're not. We're talking about partisanship at the max. We are talking about things that are shocking, appalling, partisanship that, and whether or not this, what it all boils down to is only this and this only. Has the president, everybody agrees that he's done some pretty sketchy stuff. Everybody agrees that that perfect phone call with Ukraine was not so perfect. Everybody agrees that there are things that are totally inappropriate here. But what we don't agree on, and even the people defending the president have said, hey, I don't like the guy. I didn't vote for the guy. But yes, these actions were inappropriate. They were out of line, but they are not impeachable. That's what we're hearing from the president's friends. That's what we're hearing from the people that have been defending the president. And then on the other side, of course, it's impeachable. We heard some rather esteemed constitutional scholars yesterday, and it is true that they were brought in by the Democratic majority in the Judiciary Committee. But that's all that you want to boil everything else away? That's what it is. Has what the president done that most, I won't say everybody, because boy, there are those individuals who would go to the wall for Donald Trump. He can do no wrong. He is perfect. That phone call was perfect. Nothing has been even slightly out of bounds. There are those individuals. But for most of us, the only decision really to be made here is, has the president committed an impeachable and a convictable offense? So, yes, we will be talking about impeachment, and we'll be doing that in several different ways. John Curtis will join us. Representative Rob Bishop will join us. Kirk Jowers will be our guest. Ben McAdams will be on the line. We're going to talk about a few other things, too, including the distasteful robocalls that most of us absolutely hate. Ben McAdams will address that along with the Attorney General's office in the state of Utah. But now that I've laid out the somewhat interesting agenda for the program today, there is that little gateway that I must pass each and every day. And Robin Garfield is here with us.
Limping along.
Limping. I know. Still the toothache, huh?
Still. Tomorrow morning.
No miracle cures yet?
No. I danced under the full moon last night, but it wasn't even a full moon, so I guess that's why.
You weren't howling.
I wasn't howling. No.
Okay.
There we go.
I don't know.
Got to get my full moon and my howl on.
When I have a toothache, I could very well be out in the backyard howling.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It's been a lot of groaning at our house and tolerating by the people who live with me. But.
And to have a root canal and the movie show at the same time, I don't know how you could endure it.
Maybe I'll combine the two and give you a review at the end.
Yeah, on Monday I'll ask you which was worse. Anyway, okay, what have you got for us today?
All right, this is a top headline on KSL.com. Logan City has become Utah's third city to ban plastic bags, single-use plastic bags. You see that?
Right.
You have a plastic bag opinion?
You know, I am becoming not a fan of plastic bags or the little, and we don't see it much anymore, but the little plastic doohickeys that hold, you know, our six packs of Diet Coke, and I hear some other beverages as well together. You know, one time I came home and I couldn't find our little dog Gemini. And Chi-Chi was there, okay. We affectionately called him the fat boy. And then we also had another. And I said, and finally I looked at our dog Sonny and I said, where's Gemini? And I'll be darned, trotted downstairs. Gemini had his head through a plastic, you know, handle type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't in danger of dying, but oh, my goodness. And then when you read what it's doing to the oceans and even the stuff that disintegrates, allegedly, all of the particles that are floating around that we're breathing each and every day, I'm becoming less and less a fan. And, you know, I can live without a plastic bag.
So we just moved here from California, and they banned them everywhere.
Yeah.
And we just brought home paper sacks, and yeah. I'm a fan of the ban.
Well, and even now, you know, out at the recycling center, you know, out at the Jordan landfill, I can't remember the exact name of it right now, where they're doing all kinds of disbursements and separations of recyclable items, and then also capturing methane gases for electrical generation. They're just plastic bags are the bane of their existence.
Yeah, they're hard to get rid of.
They're hard to get rid of. They gum up. If they miss one and it goes through the machinery, there's a chance it could, you know, just gum everything up, grind up the gears and everything else. So I am in sympathy with that. I don't like nanny state stuff.
Right.
But sometimes you just go, no, this is a big deal.
Yeah. All right, there's the first. Here's the second one, because we've talked a lot about texting and phones. Walking while texting and other cell phone related injuries are on the rise, especially for the youth.
Yeah. Do you remember when that first became kind of an issue? There were some of those YouTube things that showed people walking along, slamming right into a telephone pole.
Or a manhole.
Tripping right over and falling in a fountain at the mall. I mean, it's hilarious, but and I have never injured myself yet or totally, you know, brought myself to a state of degradation, but I've come close a couple of times.
Yeah, you get distracted.
I'm walking along, and you'll look up, and you almost ran over some, you know, sweet little old lady with her walker or something. Yeah.
Yeah, they're on the rise. Injuries have risen steeply over the last 20 years, obviously, because there weren't cell phone-related injuries 20 years ago.
You know what I have to do? And it came from either an interview that I did or something, but is it worth dying for? And you know, I'll feel my phone vibrate, and I know, and I'm maybe 6 or 7 minutes away from my destination, and I go, can this wait for 7 minutes, or is it worth dying for?
Yeah. My thought with that is I have young children who will someday be driving, and I'm trying to set an example in the car of what I hope they will be doing in 6 years, whatever, when they're in the car. I tell my husband, don't text. I mean, it's dangerous, but don't ever do it when the kids are in the car, especially because then they're going to start doing it.
I will not rat her out, and it's not my wife.
Okay.
I will not rat her out, but there is someone in my circle and family that got quite a hefty fine, whopper fine, from a very unsympathetic cop who pulled her over and said, you were texting and driving.
She got caught.
Oh, man. And she got whopped for
it. Yeah. Yeah, it's dangerous.
Big bucks.
All right, last one. We're out of time, as always. Disney's announced...
Time is irrelevant
I
to
know,
me.
It really is. And today, who knows what time it is.
I know. Today, especially you.
Especially with my painkillers. It could be midnight. I have no idea.
Uh-huh.
All right, Disney's announced a new live-action Mulan movie.
Yes.
Comes out next year. They released a trailer today. I haven't actually watched the trailer. I just heard
the story
about it.
I haven't seen it either.
No.
I heard about it.
Are you a fan of these new live-action remakes?
You know, I've said several times that I'm not, and then I see it, and it's actually pretty good. Although, I'm kind of getting to the point where how many times can you remake something?
Yeah.
Holy cow, isn't there some original stuff out there? And, you know, like Lion King, when I heard they were going to redo Lion King, and it was still going to be not live-action, but, boy, it looks live-action. I went in with a real chip on my shoulder, and I still like the first one best, but I marveled at the technology,
yeah.
And I liked it.
Yeah, I didn't see it. I saw the trailers for it. I only go to movies if my kids want to go, and they didn't want to go see that. But it looked the animation looked good, but still a little off with the animals.
Yeah.
Was it believable that they were live?
Well, there were times when I would go, how did they get that animal to do that? And then I go, no, they're generated here.
Yeah.
But, you know, some of the live action's been pretty good. It really has. And, you know, and a lot of the animated movies were from live action movies or live, you know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So, who knows?
All right.
It seems like, speaking of recycling, there has to be some original stuff.
Right? Yeah, I'm with you on this, but they just keep dragging them up and dragging them up. Okay, very last question, because
yes.
It's a holiday-related question. I have to ask one a day in December. What's on the right family schedule for Christmas activities? What do you go? What are your traditions? Where do you go every year?
We always go to Hale Center Theater, and so when the fam is out here, Dee's family comes out this year in two waves, and the first wave, we're going to go see Seussical, and that's almost always a tradition to either go to Christmas Carol something that is showing, and we always go to a movie. We do that for sure. And there are a few other things that we do. You know, we often, you know, gather for the stocking openings at my mother's house and, you know, things like that.
Oh, no. We're going to a Festival of Trees tonight. It's the first year I've been in 5 years because we've been
really?
Out of the state. And so we went every year growing up. So I'm thrilled to take my kids to
that. Isn't that amazing to watch the evolution of that? We had the person on
the festival. Yeah, that was fantastic.
I can remember when it was just a couple of trees. Then I remember when it was only big trees, mm-hmm. and then they added smaller trees.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the year they added wreaths, and all of the doors, I think they got most of them from Salvation Army or DI or whatever.
Yeah, they hang them up.
And they're hanging all these wreaths and the food.
The gingerbread houses, all the little ornate. I'm excited for that. So that's
incredible. How
we're
much
going to that tonight, and I'm very, very excited for that.
Good
if
for
I can
you.
Keep my bearings for that one.
Yeah, that's right. Pop a few more Tylenol.
Right. Well, okay. We're done.
All right. Sounds good. I want to report tomorrow how the root canal goes.
I will let you know for sure.
All right. We'll do a Dougathon to help pay for it. Whoa. Okay. All right. We have much more in store for you coming right up here at KSL News Radio. We're going to run through some of the things that are happening in the impeachment. But Rich Woodruff, the Director of Communications and Marketing for the Utah and Nevada region from the Red Cross, will join us. We like to highlight one of these great charitable organizations that is doing wonderful things, not only at this time of year, but throughout the year. Red Cross is next.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless. And I will never understand it. I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Each day over the last little while, regardless of what else is happening in the news, we have tried to highlight some of the really good things that are happening in our communities and opportunities to give. It's ironic, as we were preparing for this, I was just looking at the crawl. I couldn't hear the conversation, but the crawl on Fox News was that Americans' charitable giving is down and significantly over the last little while. And there are so many needs within our community. Isn't that interesting that charitable giving would be down when everybody's talking about the robust economy, how well the stock market is doing, and so on? And then we were reading how every 8 minutes someone affected by a disaster in our country turns to the Red Cross for support. So we are turning to the Red Cross. Rich Woodruff is on the line with us, Director of Communications and Marketing. And Rich, I think about the things just you and I have talked about over the years, and the incredible role that Red Cross plays. Maybe you could tell us, while all of us were sitting back watching ball games and devouring turkey, what some people were doing over that course of 72 hours regarding the Red Cross.
Well, thank you, Doug. Yeah, we appreciate you giving us this opportunity. And you did allude to disasters. You know, a lot of people may not realize the Red Cross, you know, we respond to over 64,000 disasters a year, and most of those, by far, about 90% of these home fires. So, and multifamily fires and that sort of thing. So, yeah, this past week was a good illustration of how busy we can get and how, when things happen, we are there. We are going to respond. We had several single-family fires. We had a couple apartment buildings, of course, the BYU student housing, and then in the midst of all of that, there was a chemical spill on I-15, a hazmat team, and it triggered an evacuation. I think it was a mile square radius. So we had over 100 people that needed somewhere to go, and so we set up basically an evacuation center so we could take care of them, you know, give them some hot chocolate, a little encouragement. And so every day there is something going on that, you know, every 8 minutes there's some type of disaster we respond to. So yeah, that's kind of what we're in the business of doing, and yeah, we do get very busy, and last week is a good illustration of that.
How can people in our KSL listening area, which extends way over, you know, state lines, over our surrounding states, how can we all get together and help Red Cross?
Well, you know, we function, again, a lot of, one of the did you knows, some people think we've been around over 137 years, but they think we're government funded. We're not. We're supported strictly by the generosity of our donors and of course the power of volunteers. Over 90% of our workforce is actually volunteers. So to get back to your question, there's really three things that the public can do that we very much appreciate. You can give the gift of time, you can volunteer, and certainly financially give money, and also give blood. You know, blood donations also take a big dip this time of year, and we want to remind people of that as well. So part of what we're doing right now is we're messaging this is the time of year where people are in sort of a giving mode, if you will, and so we have our messaging, and it's our annual holiday campaign. It's kind of a unique approach, and it makes your giving much, much more tangible. In other words, what would a $5 donation, you know, fund or purchase? So we've made it very easy for people to donate, and we can talk about that if you have some questions on that as we go through our discussion.
Yeah, I would love to talk about that just in the time we have here before the top of the hour. How sure. can people make their donations? And boy, if there's one thing that I've become kind of the believer in, you know, often we want an object lesson for our kids and grandkids, and I get that, gathering up food, blankets, whatever it might be. But if there's something that I have become an absolute convert to, it is the gift of money and how frugal you guys are with it and can make that money go distances and stretch further than most of us can even imagine.
Yeah, we appreciate that acknowledgement. Yeah, in fact, we are extremely efficient. You know, part of that because we're so volunteer driven. But you know, we're proud to let the public know that on average, an average of 90 cents of every dollar that we spend is invested in delivering care and comfort to those in need. So it's very efficient. We're lean and mean, and especially when you see these large-scale disasters, these operations can get extremely expensive. And, you know, you have a few thousand volunteers on the ground in, say, a Hurricane Harvey or whatever, very costly, very expensive. And the public is very generous in helping to fund those operations and get the comfort and care of those that are affected by this.
And boy, and other than your loved ones and your health and things like that, what is more precious and more valuable to anybody than time and money and blood? And we all can give that, give of our time, give of our blood, and hopefully most of us could give of our money. How do we do that? How, if I want to write a check to you right now or send you some money via whatever, how do I do it?
Well, we have, you know, you mentioned giving something. Our theme is give something that means something. And the answer to the question, if you go to redcross.org, you're going to see right away ways to give. Our holiday campaign, we have a catalog. What you can do is you can make a donation in honor of special people in your life. And we also have some nice, you know, gifts, thank you gifts as well. But, for example, a $50 donation would fund an emergency shelter stay for a person. $25 would pay for 5 blankets. You see the iconic branded Red Cross blankets, yeah. Of course, comfort kits, toiletries, $5 donation there. I mean, you know, anywhere from $5 to $1,000 on up, it really does make a difference. So again, if you want to go to redcross.org/holidaygifts, and you can link to it from the website, you'll see that. You can either give online. You can mail an enclosed form that's part of the catalog if you want to download that. And you can also call 1-866-465-GIFT. So, but again, since people are probably not going to catch that and write it down, I would just say go to redcross.org, and we make it very easy it's very intuitive to navigate that website.
Rich, I appreciate you joining us today. Thank you as always. Thanks for all you do at Red Cross.
Well, thank you, Doug, and thank you for your listeners. You know, we're so appreciative that the support we get from Utahns is just fantastic, and especially this time of year, a nice reminder to let people know about the need, and we appreciate the support.
Redcross.org. Let's take a break here at the top of the hour. When we come back, we'll walk through a few of the things that unfolded earlier today in Washington, D.C. regarding the impeachment of Donald J. Trump. That's coming up next.
The afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
I don't know how many of you had the opportunity to actually hear the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, this morning step to the podium with American flags behind her and had comments regarding the articles of impeachment. For those who didn't hear it, it's about 5 minutes long, and I thought that we would play it for you now so everybody knows exactly if you didn't catch it live this morning and maybe you've just heard sound bites, but this is what the speaker actually said.
Let us begin where our founders began in 1776, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bonds which have connected them with another. With those words, our founders courageously began our Declaration of Independence from an oppressive monarch, for among other grievances, the king's refusal to follow rightfully passed laws. In the course of today's events, it becomes necessary for us to address, among other grievances, the president's failure to faithfully execute the law. When crafting the Constitution, the founders feared the return of a monarchy in America. And having just fought a war of independence, they specifically feared the prospect of a king president corrupted by foreign influence. During the Constitutional Convention, James Madison, the architect of the Constitution, warned that a president might betray his trust to foreign powers, which might prove fatal to the Republic. Another founder, Governor Morris, feared that a president may be bribed by a greater interest to betray his trust. He emphasized that this magistrate is not the king. The people are the king. They therefore created a constitutional remedy to protect against a dangerous or corrupt leader, impeachment. unless the Constitution contained an impeachment provision, one founder warned, a president might, quote, spare no effort or means whatsoever to get himself reelected. Similarly, George Mason insisted that a president who procured his appointment in his first instance through improper and corrupt acts might repeat his guilt and return to power. During the debate over impeachment at the Constitutional Convention, George Mason also asked, shall any man be above justice? Shall that man be above it who can commit the most extensive injustice? In his great wisdom, he knew that injustice committed by the president erodes the rule of law, the very idea that of fair justice, which is the bedrock of our democracy. And if we allow a president to be above the law, we do so surely at the peril of our republic. In America, no one is above the law. Over the past few weeks, through the Intelligence Committee working with the Foreign Affairs and Oversight Committees, the American people have heard the testimony of truly patriotic career public servants, distinguished diplomats, and decorated war heroes, some of the president's own appointees. The facts are uncontested. The president abused his power for his own personal political benefit at the expense of our national security by withholding military aid and crucial Oval Office meeting in exchange for an announcement of an investigation into his political rival. Yesterday, the Judiciary Committee, at the Judiciary Committee, the American people heard testimony from leading American constitutional scholars who illuminated without a doubt that the president's actions are a profound violation of the public trust. The president's actions have seriously violated the Constitution, especially when he says and acts upon the belief Article 2 says I can do whatever I want. No. His wrongdoing strikes at the very heart of our Constitution, a separation of powers, three co-equal branches, each a check and balance on the other. A republic, if we can keep, said Benjamin Franklin. Our democracy is what is at stake. The president leaves us no choice but to act because he is trying to corrupt once again the election for his own benefit. The president has engaged in abuse of power, undermining our national security and jeopardizing the integrity of our elections. His actions are in defiance of the vision of our founders and the oath of office that he takes to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Sadly, but with confidence and humility, with allegiance to our founders and a heart full of love for America, today I am asking our chairman to proceed with articles of impeachment. I commend our committee chairs and our members for their somber approach to actions which I wish the president had not made necessary. In signing the Declaration of Independence, our founders invoked a firm reliance on divine providence. Democrats, too, are prayerful, and we will proceed in a manner worthy of our oath of office to support and defend the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic. So help us God.
That was the Speaker of the House of the United States of America, and in her comments talked about the failure to absolutely uphold the rule of law, talked about a king president that could be corrupted by a foreign power. That was referring to back, she quoted a lot from the Founding Fathers. Talked about removing a dangerous or corrupt leader, also that goes back to the founding days. She did say that the facts are uncontested. I would argue that. I think the facts are uncontested, and that's why it is being taken to trial, or will be, because the actual impeachment isn't in place until the House votes on it. I think it's a given fact, but at that point it will go to the Senate, and then they will listen to the case, as it were. She talked about Article 2, how the president has said, and the president is famous for saying rather outlandish and hyperbole and exaggerated things, that he can do whatever he wants under Article 2 of the Constitution, which clearly he cannot. And this was probably the key when she said, try to corrupt once again our national election, implying that that happened in 2016 as well. One quick thing that I wanted to share with you, we're going to talk with Congressman Curtis coming up next. But usually, once a statement was made, especially when it's a somber announcement like this, and Nancy Pelosi was trying to be very deliberate and very somber about this, not appearing to be gleeful or relishing this in any way, shape, or form, just kind of turned on her heels and walked off stage right. Well, usually that walk is completed. Today it was not. When someone shouted out, and at first there was confusion what was actually said, but basically what we discovered later is that a reporter in the distance, you will not, we could not hear it at the time, but people did say, yes, this is indeed what he said, who were on the site, that he said, basically, do you hate Donald Trump? This is what the speaker did and said.
Representative Collins yesterday suggested that the Democrats are doing this simply because they don't like the guy.
I have nothing to do with it. Let me just say this.
I think it's an important
point. I think the president is a coward when it comes to helping our kids who are afraid of gun violence. I think he is cruel when he doesn't deal with helping our dreamers, of which we're very proud. I think he's in denial about the climate crisis. However, that's about the election. This is about the election. Take it up in the election. This is about the Constitution of the United States and the facts that lead to the president's violation of his oath of office. And as a Catholic, I resent your using the word hate in a sentence that addresses me. I don't hate anyone. I was raised in a way that is full, a heart full of love, and always prayed for the president. And I still pray for the president. I pray for the president all the time. So don't mess with me when it comes to words like that.
It was indeed an interesting moment. It truly was. We didn't have the part. It was kind of unintelligible, but it's kind of interesting to listen to it, even though, because you can hear the tension. It is crackling in the air. And as Nancy Pelosi is, something got her attention, and it was when, do you hate Donald Trump? And boy, she turned on her heels, looked into the audience at whoever shouted that, had some responses even out there, and then decided to walk back to the podium. That rarely, rarely happens, especially when somebody is making an announcement like that. I've seen presidents who have resisted. I've seen senators. I've seen diplomats. But boy, Nancy Pelosi just really took umbrage at that. All right. We will play Kevin McCarthy's response to everything a little later on in the program. Our representative from the 3rd Congressional District will be joining us coming up next, Representative John Curtis. So stay with us here at KSL News Radio.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
I'll be very honest with you on this one, as I always try to be. I don't know. Did the President of the United States do something that warrants not only impeachment, but the conviction? And I don't know. I'll tell you, as I have openly admitted, and regretfully so, that there is hardly a day that goes by that this president doesn't disappoint me, embarrass me, or sometimes I'm just outright appalled. But I also want to be fair, and I don't know. I have a very good friend who is a constitutional law professor at one of our major universities, and he and I, along with others, we have dinner once a month. He is a Democrat, leans a little more liberal than me, and he said, Doug, and he is no fan of President Trump, believe me, but he did say, at this point, now this was weeks ago, at this point, I am not convinced that an impeachable offense has occurred. There very well may have been. I want to hear more. And I'm beginning to wonder that maybe we need to take it out of the House's hands at this point and send it to the Senate for another airing over there. And I don't know. It's sad that we are at this stage. And again, everybody, this is a sad thing when even your really good friends and those that are basically on the docket to defend you are going, oh, no, he was clearly in the wrong. Oh, no, that was absolutely inappropriate. Oh, no, this is really sketchy. And no, I didn't vote for him. No, I don't like him. But I just don't know if it's impeachable. That was his best defense yesterday, which was kind of amazing. Representative John Curtis is joining us on the line right now. Representative, always good to chat with you, representing our 3rd Congressional District. You're back there in Washington, not directly on any of the committees that we have had so far, but what's your take on everything? How is this being digested in Washington?
Well, first of all, it's good to speak with you, Doug, and so much respect for you, and enjoy your show. And I'm sure glad the early rumors of your demise on the radio were not true. You're back.
But they will be mid next week. Those rumors will be back.
I'll believe it when I see it. I'm just glad you're on. Hey, you know, as I was listening to you waiting to come on, I just had this really strong thought, which is, given what you've said about the uncertainty of even some of his toughest critics, that almost is reason right there not to move forward with impeachment. If there's that much question, if they have not been able to gather really a single Republican congressman who is willing to say, yeah, I'm with you on that, that's almost the indication that you need right there to say, wait a minute, we've not got something here that we should be moving forward with.
It's hard sometimes when it's hard to be disappointed in somebody. I have never really, honestly, I need to be totally candid. I've always seen Donald Trump as I used to. Somebody said, you've called him names. Yeah, I called him the P.T. Barnum of politics. And he is. I mean, he clearly is. If anybody can turn anything into a show, whether it's the building of a building, a hearing on zoning, or whether it's a reality TV show, or now as president of the United States, or the previous election, he can turn it into a 3-ring circus. He really can. I stand by my words. He is the P.T. Barnum of politics. But when he became president, I made that vow to myself. I told my listeners at the time, I'm going to do everything I can to bend over backwards, and where I can, in good conscience, I want to and will try to support this president. But holy cow, that's been hard.
It has. But let me just say, you know, we knew all of those things that you just clicked off when he was elected. And that's one of the things that's hard for me right now is to say, well, you know, given everything that you've just said about your feelings for him, which are shared by many, many Utahns, as you well know, Utah struggles with this issue because at core, you know, the conservative values are very strong, but the behavior is hard. But all of those things were known when he was elected, and yet 63 million Americans still chose to cast their vote for him.
Yeah, I know, and I think it's the classic example of the worst choice probably in the history of the United States that people had. And now we're hearing rumblings today. I don't know if you're aware of this, John, but it looks like Hillary Clinton might be at least sending up some maybe lead balloons on this. When you start off on the Howard Stern show, you kind of wonder, but she's out there, you know, kind of fessing up and telling her inner thoughts. And I'm going, why here and why now? And is she going to run again?
She's clearly not the answer to this problem. I'm laughing because months ago I was at dinner with Kevin McCarthy, and he went around the table and said, predict who will win the Democratic nomination. And I surprised the whole table, and I said, Hillary Clinton. So the fact that she's poking up only validates what I thought months ago. We'll see, but I don't think that's the answer. I mean, that's not the answer I don't think Americans are looking for, would be my guess.
Boy, sometimes, you know, when you look at a scenario like that, it's like the old horror movie where no matter how many silver bullets are shot or stakes through the heart, it still rises out of the boiling pot, you know, and you go, oh, how does this happen? What are you anticipating? I'm hearing there could be a vote on this next week in the House.
Well, so there's another disappointment, I think, for us as Republicans is, okay, so you're going to draft articles of impeachment when we've hardly even heard the Judiciary Committee, right? I mean, they've done really nothing, and yet they're drafting articles of impeachment. What are they drafting them on, and what will they look like? And we're really going to move that quickly. and vote on something of this consequence. And so if you're like me and many of my colleagues who are really trying to look at this with an open mind and really trying to understand everything and digest everything, to say, okay, well, we're just gonna take a stab at some articles of impeachment, throw them on the wall and see if they stick, ask people to vote on them. My guess is you're going to see a straight party line vote on something like that, and it's going to move over to the Senate. You're not going to get the satisfaction, I say you, in a
sure,
broad sense.
Sure.
Your listeners are not going to get the satisfaction they're looking for of a thoughtful review over in the Senate. They're going to vote on it quickly and dismiss it, and we're going to be, you know, right back where we were before all this started. And then the question is, do those who so dislike the president, what is their next move? Is there another Mueller report? Is there another impeachment? What is left for them after this?
I felt this way from square one, and especially, and you're right, this will not go through the Senate. There's no way they can come up something so almost unimaginable, because so far this candidate, this president, has done the unimaginable. I cannot even conceive what would cause there to be the two-thirds majority in the Senate. And you know, after I've said from the beginning, for people who are not big fans of Donald Trump, it's time to look at the 2020 election, either in the Republican Party or on the Democratic side. And I'm not seeing any Republicans, and I'm not seeing the Democrat yet that I believe can beat him.
Well, I said this a lot, that if Republicans were, several months ago, had sat down and drawn up a playbook on how to get President Trump reelected, we couldn't have come up with a scenario as good as is what's unfolding.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. John, it's always great to chat with you next week. As a matter of fact, at this time, Lee Lonsberry will be doing this radio program. And so we'll chat, though, on TV, I'm sure. But this might be the last time, at least publicly, I have to say, have a very Merry Christmas. My best to you and your family.
You as well. Thanks, Doug.
Representative John Curtis with us. Let's take a break here at the bottom of the hour. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Representative Rob Bishop, 1st District here in the state of Utah. I primarily wanted to talk to Rob about kind of the precedents and the history and what indeed does happen, what goes on behind the scenes when we are in the process of impeaching a president. That's coming up next.
The afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Boy, everybody's trying to sort all of this out, and where are we going? What is going to happen? And this morning when I was listening to the speaker, and then I listened to the minority leader in the House, Kevin McCarthy, I listened to their comments. It's kind of dueling and battling founding fathers this morning on the impeachment issue. But I thought, you know, I want to call Rob Bishop from the 1st Congressional District and not so much talk with Congressman Bishop, but talk with historian Rob Bishop, parliamentarian Rob Bishop, about what is unfolding and what is likely to unfold. Plus, we got word of something kind of cool that happened regarding a real wooden cane. We want to get into that, too. And, Rob, always a pleasure to have you join us. Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much. Those kind words, too bad I don't resemble them.
Well, we'll pretend here for the all right, for the sake of the argument today. First of all, what is likely to happen? I was trying to do a little of my own research this morning, and I was looking at some of the facts and figures, and it was interesting at this very time during the inquiry regarding Clinton, 29% of the country wanted him impeached at that time. During this exact point, during the inquiry, impeachment inquiry with Richard Nixon, which ultimately resulted, of course, in the resignation, he was at 38% of the people in the nation. And right now, President Trump is at 44%. It is so weird to look at all the statistics and everything else on what is happening. What is going to happen over the next several weeks and months?
Well, I don't know. But it's interesting for you to use those numbers. I certainly hope that is not the rationale that people use, you know, public support to do. It goes back to Alexander Hamilton when they were drafting the Constitution. They came up with this provision who said it will always be the greatest danger that the decision to use impeachment would be driven by partisan animosities instead of, you know, the real demonstrations of guilt or innocence. I really think that's what we are seeing here today, and it's a sad process. It's sad that we have devolved into that kind of element with it. So I hope members of Congress aren't looking at polls to make their decisions. I hope they're looking at real evidence in some particular way. And to be honest, I haven't seen that real hard evidence. I've heard a lot of people's feelings, their frustrations, their wishes, their desires, their unhappiness with the election. But, I mean, there are precedents. I think last time I talked to you, we talked about Samuel Chase affair, as well as what Hamilton said, that impeachment should never be used as purely a partisan ploy to change an election. If you don't like somebody, vote them out at the next election. Don't try and use this process as the vehicle to do that.
Right. And the partisanship that has been involved in the two that have happened in my lifetime that actually went through the impeachment proceedings, Richard Nixon's was kind of hijacked into a resignation, if that's the proper term. But it was so partisan in 1998. It is so partisan now. The shoes happen to be on different feet. And you do wonder, and I have quoted you often, saying that ever since you became a congressman in the 1st Congressional District, whomever is president at the moment, you have people clamoring for his impeachment. And I normally would say his or hers, but we have yet to have a female president. But this is something that everybody is telling me. The second a new president is in, there is somebody, there are groups, there is that individual or that organization that is clamoring for their removal.
Yeah, and that is not the way government should operate. So we'll just have to see. I am sure that Speaker Pelosi probably has the votes to actually push an article of impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also sure there are probably not the votes necessarily in the Senate to actually convict on impeachment. So the entire process we would go through would end up where we are right now, and there are so many other issues of such significance that we're not discussing on the floor, and we're simply not doing. The last 2 weeks we were in session, we dealt with one bill for the entire week.
Wow. And, you know, Speaker Pelosi brought that up today and placed the blame. She and you and I have had this conversation. I used to have this conversation with your predecessor, Jim Hansen. The fact that things were being done generally in the House, and they would always get hung up, as, again, Jim used to say, in the House of Lords. Today, Nancy Pelosi mentioned the same thing. She gave the number, she gave some specifics, and said, why isn't Mitch McConnell doing anything?
Okay. Yeah, we can play those games all over the place. If you look at the kinds of bills, so we have two types of bills. Those that are the major ones that require a rule that goes through the Rules Committee, says what amendments can be made, takes an hour debate on the floor, versus the bills that are pretty easy and simple ones that are two-thirds majority, they are simply suspension bills. We are passing a lot of suspensions. We're naming post offices and reauthorizing separate things. Those do take a long time for the Senate to actually move on them. But the rule bills, the significant ones like, you know, the trade treaty
right,
that would replace NAFTA, we haven't ever, I mean, it's ready to go. It has the votes, I think, on both sides of the aisles. She just has to bring it and put it on the floor. And for months, she's just been postponing doing that. We have the National Defense Authorization Act, which is ready to go. There are a couple of leadership positions in which they're bickering over, which they want to add stuff to the military bill that has nothing to do with the military. If they just get off that kick and put the military stuff on the floor, it's ready to go, and it needs to go. We actually are hurting the military every time you do a continuing resolution and don't give them the funds for the new programs that would be authorized that way. We still have the budget. We're still doing a continuing resolution through the 20th, and we'll probably do another continuing resolution after Christmas. Those budget issues should be finished and finalized and put to the floor. So the big stuff, the important stuff, that's not going anywhere right now. And I'm sorry, she can look at numbers, but that really is her responsibility and the majority leader's responsibility of scheduling the big issues for the floor. We're just not doing that.
As we've already discussed, it looks as if the articles of impeachment will be crafted and voted upon, and then it will go to the Senate. Are we going to see what we saw back in 1998? Are we going to see House members become the managers and the case made before the Senate? And how long will it take to go through that process, in your opinion?
Yes, that is the way it has to be. So there would be leadership. In this case, it would be Judiciary Committee leadership are the ones who are traditionally, I don't know if it's actually formalized into rule, but they are traditionally those that become the managers. And unless there is overwhelming evidence, I mean, in the Clinton era, I am told, because I wasn't back here, they say if they had moved for a resolution of censure, that may have easily passed. But the impeachment went a step too far, and so they didn't get any kind of bipartisan support. I think you'll see that same thing happen here if it goes that far. And one of the things also is the Senate has said if they go through their hearing process of the trial, they will only allow direct testimony, not hearsay evidence of what somebody told them or what somebody felt was going on at that time, which basically means most of the stuff we have heard over the past few weeks in the Intelligence Committee and now in Judiciary would not even be allowed as evidence over on the Senate side.
Interesting. In the few moments that we have left, you know, it's nice to be able to talk about something really cool that has happened. And I was forwarded a story that you were asked to deliver a special gift on behalf of a retired Air Force colonel here in West Point, Utah, to Representative Scalise. Tell us a little bit about this.
This is really kind of cool. So he's a retired military. Last name is Holly. Lives up there, as you said, in North Davis County, West Point. And he carves canes. He came up to the site. He came up with what he calls cane foo. So he's found a way of self-defense by using canes for those that have limited other ability to use other parts of the body. So he saw that Scalise was walking with an old, crusty metal cane, and he didn't say that wasn't cool enough. So he actually made by hand a cane for Scalise. He put the LSU Tiger, I think his nickname is Mike,
right,
on the handle for him. His name is on it. He gave it to him, and canes need to be adjusted to the height. So he gave him a whole series of what you do on how you actually get the right height for the cane. And actually, Scalise, when it was given to him on the floor, was really touched. He was grateful that someone would be that considerate of him and looking out for him and doing something that kind. So it was kind of a touching moment when I gave him the cane on the floor. And Scalise said he was going to at least write Holly a thank you note, a long, generous thank you note. So, you know, at some point you or some of your followers back there may want to talk to this guy, especially about what cane foo is all about.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm hearing that KSL will have a brand spanking new talk show guy on the air next week at this very time. I think that ought to be one of the first things he does.
Yeah, that sounds good. Is this kind of a promo for him?
Yeah, some guy named Lee Lonsberry. You might be familiar with him. I hear that he has been a communications guy for a United States representative back there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
if he's on his way out there, maybe that's why he's not responding to my stuff I put on his desk.
Oh, there we go. Rob, thank you so much for joining us today. It's always such a pleasure.
It's always good to talk to you, and I hope as time goes on, you repeatedly come back here and take over spots here and there for KSL.
Well, I promise you it will always be a bloodless coup.
Okay.
Yeah, no blood involved here. Rob, have a great, great Christmas with you and your family, okay?
Take care.
Our first district congressman out of the great state of Utah, Rob Bishop. When we come back, we'll talk with the former director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics. We'll get his take on what's unfolding, yes, with the articles of impeachment in Washington, D.C.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Well, normally when we put in a phone call to my friend Kirk Jowers, former director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, we're, you know, interrupting his stay in Croatia or somewhere. And I understand you're in Washington, D.C. today, Kirk.
I am. I'm in our nation's capital at an interesting time. I guess it's always interesting these last few years here.
Yeah, I always love
interesting.
Washington is an amazing place, but I can't imagine kind of what it might be like up on Capitol Hill right now. In just the few moments we have before the top of the hour, what's your take on all of this, Kirk? Or are we going through an effort in futility? Absolutely. Are we going to get any good out of this at all?
No, I mean, I found myself, I just find myself offended at everything. I am offended at the president's phone call and just kind of the crude nature of how he went about what he was trying to accomplish. But I've been offended by the way the Democrats have done this impeachment process and the fact that they really, many of them, have been kind of on the hunt for this since the day he defeated, shockingly to them, Secretary Clinton. And so, but it does matter. He will almost certainly be impeached, and he'll be only the third person in the third president in the history of the United States to be impeached. No one has ever been removed from office. You know, of course, it was Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton are the two who,
right,
who have been impeached, and neither will President Trump. So in that sense, it's an exercise in futility, but it will stay as a stain on him forever, like I think it has on Johnson and Clinton thus far.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because certainly the impeachment proceedings were moving forward for President Nixon, but he thwarted it all by doing the right thing and resigning the office rather than, you know, continuing the nation's great nightmare, as it was referred to. So it's kind of amazing how often this is coming up now. And I'll ask the question. I've heard this applied to so many different things that, well, we are weaponizing this, we are weaponizing that. And I tend to agree with it. Have we now weaponized the impeachment process? Is this going to hang over the neck of any president now in the future?
Potentially. I like that you mentioned Nixon, because that was a case where it was very clear that he should be impeached and then removed from office. I think no question, and the reason we know it's no question is because on a bipartisan basis, everyone believed he should, and that's why when the Republican senators went to him and said, you'd be smart to resign because we don't have your back, he did so and didn't put the country through this process.
Right.
I think certainly in the two most recent, Clinton and Trump, what they did was terribly offensive and wrong, but probably didn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense, and so their party is not going to let them hang in the wind. But to your question on the weaponization of it, the numbers kind of represent that. You know, we'd only had one, two, if you count Nixon, really, up until 1970, and you know, now we've had, well, two since 98. On the other hand, I still think it will be used few and far between. Pelosi, I thought, was right before when she said, I'm not going to open these hearings. I think she got so much pressure, and this Ukraine call was a little different in nature than what,
yeah,
you know, AOC and the others have been wanting to impeach Trump for, which would have been clear weaponization. So I'm hopeful that it will still be used very sparingly and selectively, regardless of, you know, the partisanship of the House, Senate, and President.
Well, boy, me too, because, you know, I, as distasteful as the president has been, I have a friend, I told this story a little earlier, who is a constitutional law professor at one of our very prestigious universities here in the state of Utah, who is a Democrat, is no fan of the president at all. And he has said, and now this was weeks ago, and there's been a lot of things that have happened since, but he said, I'm just not seeing the clear impeachable offense. And then he said, yet.
Right. And I would certainly agree with that. I would think, even if I were a Democrat, I would not vote to impeach, and I would not vote to remove him from office. I would certainly entertain anything short of that, of,
yeah,
you know, saying saying he embarrassed the country and what he did was wrong and any of those types of things, probably on either side I would do it. But
do you think there's any chance of a censure? Rob Bishop alluded to maybe if they'd gone for a censure of President Clinton, they might have been successful in that. And I've only got a second here. Is there the chance of it evolve or devolving into a censure?
That's what they should have done if they actually wanted to make that stick. But, you know, but like I say, on the other hand, the House will impeach President Trump, and he will be in an ignominious group of three that has ever had that happen to him. And yeah, that may be far more powerful historically than a censure. Because there have been other censures that, you know, I can't recall off the top of my head. So yeah.
I remember a couple in the Senate, but I don't remember, you know, some of the others. Kirk, we unfortunately are out of time. I would love to chat with you for a long time about this issue, and I really appreciate you joining us today. Give my best to your family. I hope you have a great, great holiday season, and I look forward to chatting with you soon, and maybe we can do it on TV.
Thank you so much, Doug. I look forward to being with you whenever I get the chance.
Thanks so much. Kirk Jowers with us here at KSL News Radio. We're just a minute after 2 o'clock. Let's take a break for our news. And when we come back, we played Nancy Pelosi's comments this morning in their entirety. Kevin McCarthy, he gets his shot coming up next. We have that recorded from earlier today.
Insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
A little later on in the program, we are going to be talking with Ben McAdams, our 4th District Congressman. And we did not call him about impeachment. We wanted to chat with him about some of the illegal robocalls, some of the efforts that he is supporting and going through right now to make violators responsible by imposing fines and so on. We're also going to talk with the chief of the antitrust section for the Utah Attorney General's office. That's coming up here in about 10 or 15 minutes, talking about some of the phone scams and so on, robocalls that are happening, especially at this time of year. But I want to be really fair on this, and we did play the comments from Nancy Pelosi from earlier today when she said, yes, they're moving forward. They are now going to come up with the articles of impeachment. It ended up being a little interesting, as we pointed out earlier, as she walked off the stage. And normally you don't come back and you don't respond. Every now and then you'll see a president or you will see somebody of note do that. But Nancy Pelosi is not famous for doing that. She just stoically walks off the stage. Well, somebody said something regarding, do you hate Donald Trump? Oh, man, did that get up the speaker's ire, to say the least. But along with her comments, we also had and I heard one of the talking heads this morning refer to it as the rebuttal, and it kind of was, from the Republican leader, the minority leader in the House of Representatives. Let's play that. It's about 4 minutes long in its entirety. Here's Kevin McCarthy.
This morning I listened to Speaker Pelosi give us historical references. The one that she skipped was Alexander Hamilton, when he wrote, "There will always be the greatest danger that the decision to use the impeachment power would be driven by partisan animosity instead of real demonstrations of innocence or guilt." Today is the day that Hamilton warned us. Today, with the Speaker's announcement, she has weakened this nation. It was not new news. They always had this pre-written timeline from the day they got sworn in. Let's go through their timeline. After winning the majority, they had to decide who would become the chairs of their committees. The impeachment committee judiciary had a campaign for it. Nadler campaigned on the theme that he would be the best for impeachment, and he won the position. On the very first day of swearing in by their new freshmen, they got them the majority. After holding their hand up and swearing to the Constitution, in celebration that night, Congresswoman Tlaib said, "We are going to impeach the mother." That was their goal from the beginning. Or in May of 2019 of this year, Al Green, who has entered the impeachment from the very beginning, said, "If we do not impeach the president, he will get reelected," to show him the true reason of why their timeline is written. The sad part about this timeline, they've always had it written, they just never had a case or proof, so they had to bring professors in. had Speaker Pelosi spent at least 48 hours and waited until the transcript came forth, America would not have to go through this nightmare. If Speaker Pelosi would have paused and actually listened to the hearing yesterday, she probably would not have made the decision that she made today to try to change her own timeline. Had she listened to the Democrat constitutional scholar, Jonathan Turley, he said there was no bribery, no extortion, no obstruction of justice, no abuse of power. He said this would be the fastest, thinnest, weakest impeachment in U.S. history. This is from the individual who did not vote for the president. This is from the individual who is not a Republican. The further they get from their timeline, the further they get away from their own requirements of an impeachment. Even if this year of March, the Speaker of the House said impeachment was so destructive to the nation that it had to be overwhelming, compelling, and bipartisan. That was the criteria she laid out for the nation and for her conference. It's just not the criteria she held herself to. This is the day that Alexander Hamilton feared and warned would come. This is the day the nation is weaker because they surely cannot put their animosity or their fear of losing an election in the future in front of all the other things that the American people want. They don't even have a budget. We don't even have a trade agreement that was signed more than a year ago to make this country stronger. We're not lowering drug prices. We're not rebuilding this nation. Why? Because the timeline that they started from the day they were sworn in down to the very freshmen announcing what they would do on the night they were sworn in to the selection of the chairs of who would oversee the impeachment has come true today. It's not a day that history will be proud of. It's not a day I hope America ever repeats.
Interesting, isn't it? Boy, sometimes you feel like you're almost in an alternative universe talking about some of these things and just how different somebody's presentation can be. But there is one common denominator that we're hearing in every this. It's been the battle of the founding fathers. And I will tell you right here and right now, that's always risky business. You start quoting the founding fathers, and guess what? They were interesting folks. They were real, just like you and me. We tend to deify them now and put them on pedestals. And there's no doubt they were an incredible group of people at that time, our founding fathers and mothers. But they were not without flaws. They were not without contrasting points of view. They were not immune from occasionally contradicting themselves. And since every Republican right now is quoting Alexander Hamilton, I thought it would be interesting to go to most of the sources for the recent rejuvenation, as David McCullough was responsible for kind of the rejuvenation of interest in John Adams. Well, it's Ron Chernow. And I've read the book, and many of you probably have too. It was the inspiration for the stage play, Hamilton. Now, that's a rather fanciful view, but nonetheless, it's entertaining. So have you ever wondered what Ron Chernow, who immersed himself in Alexander Hamilton up to his eyeballs for years and years, crafting that massive book? Let me tell you what Ron Chernow said. And I'm not going to, this is an article that he wrote, but I'll quote the first several paragraphs. President Trump has described the impeachment proceedings as a coup, and his White House counsel has termed them unconstitutional. This would come as a surprise to Alexander Hamilton, who wrote not only the 11 essays in The Federalist outlining and defending the powers of the presidency, but also the two essays devoted to impeachment. There seems to be little doubt, given his writings on the presidency, that Hamilton would have been aghast at Trump's behavior and appalled by his invitation to foreign actors to meddle in our elections. As a result, he would most certainly have endorsed the current impeachment inquiry. It's not an exaggeration to say that Trump embodies Hamilton's worst fears about the kind of person who might someday head the government. Among our founders, Hamilton's views count heavily because he was the foremost proponent of a robust presidency. Yet he also harbored an abiding fear that a brazen demagogue could seize the office. That worry helps explain why he analyzed impeachment in such detail. He viewed it as a crucial instrument to curb possible abuses arising from the enlarged powers he otherwise championed. Now, this article goes on, but as we hear all of the bloviating and we hear all of the picking and choosing of your favorite founding father, well, this is a guy that studied, and I'm not saying he's right. I don't know. I haven't dug into the life of Alexander Hamilton the way Ron Chernow has. By the way, he won the Pulitzer for his biography of Washington. He since has done the biography of Ulysses S. Grant, which is remarkable, and I've read them all. And I'll tell you, it's interesting. Be careful when you start brandishing the founding fathers. Let's take a break, and we will come right back, and we're going to delve into yet a different topic. We're going to talk about robocalls, phone scams with the Utah Attorney General's office. We'll talk with the chief of the antitrust section next.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
In light of the conversation we're anticipating with our representative in the 4th Congressional District here in a few minutes, Ben McAdams, he is working and voted for a measure to put an end to illegal robocalls. We'll talk more about that. But I thought it would be interesting to talk with someone who has some firsthand knowledge of not only robocalls, but, you know, some of the phone scams and different things that plague us all. And as we are kicking around this idea, our producer today, Amy, she was telling about a really nasty call she got and the response when she kind of played along for a minute and the obscenities and everything else. My mom, there have been attempted scams with her, you know, your grandson's in jail in California, that kind of stuff, and go get us a bunch of, you know, prepaid credit cards. And oh, my goodness. So David Sonnenreich is with us, chief of the antitrust section for the Utah Attorney General's office. And we so appreciate you joining us today. How big an issue, especially with the phone scams, and how do we deal with robocalls? Maybe you could just walk us through where we are now.
Sure, Doug. First of all, if I give you the number $54 billion, does that sound like a lot of robocalls?
That's a whole lot.
That's how many have gone on in America, we think, in this year so far without counting December. Compared to last year, was only $47 billion. That's still a lot. $30 billion the year before. So every year it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. This year so far, the average American has had about 164 robocalls. And some of those are legitimate, a lot of them are legal, but a lot of them are illegal, too. And some of the illegal ones are scams.
What makes it illegal? What is there a tipping point, a buzzword? What is it?
Actually, it's a very simple thing. Technically, a robocall is only legal if you've given somebody, if it involves selling something, you have to give that company that made the robocall permission to send robocalls to you in writing. Unless it's one of certain groups. For example, debt collectors can make robocalls to you about debts. Political calls are always allowed. Certain health care messages are allowed and charities. But in general, if it's a commercial business and it's robocalling you, you have had to give them written permission or it's illegal. But, of course, many of these calls have nothing to do with legitimate businesses at all. They're frauds. And those are always illegal.
Well, you know, you mentioned that. And I get them on my cell phone, and they are particularly annoying. Because, you know, I really try to go, you know, we're waiting for a guest to be on the show. We're looking for something. I'm anticipating a call. So I really try to answer it. And But more and more, often, this is not uncommon with us on this show at all. We'll have a guest call back on a phone that I'm not familiar, so it doesn't come up in my traditional way. I answer it, and it's somebody selling me something, and it just annoys me to death. But every single day, I'll bet you, while I was watching the impeachment stuff this morning and the comment by Nancy Pelosi and others, I'll bet you we had two while I was just sitting there in a half hour or so. Usually they don't get to the voicemail thing. Sometimes they'll wait on so long it triggers it. But it's incredible how many we get in our home.
Absolutely. And, you know, this, if there's one issue that unites Americans right now, it's a distaste for unwanted robocalls. This bill that you're talking about, that you're going to be talking shortly here, this Senate 151 just passed yesterday by 417 votes to 3 in the current House.
Yeah. When do you ever hear that, right?
You don't hear that very often. The earlier version of the vote was 97-1 in the Senate in March. And it got the support of almost every attorney general in the country, including General Reyes, in a letter that went out on March 5th to the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation. So everybody is coalesced around the idea we have to do something to improve the environment on robocalls. And that includes industry, too, because they realize that if our phones become unusable because of the number of robocalls we get, I do exactly what you do. I'll be in the middle of a meeting, and I see a robocall, and it looks like it might be an office number, and I'm wondering, is this somebody important that I've got to interrupt my meeting to talk to? Maybe it's even about the meeting.
Right.
How do I know? And then all of a sudden, everyone in the meeting gets to hear me, hello, my name is Rachel. I think your car insurance may have expired. Please let me tell you.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Well, and when it becomes so intrusive, my mother and I was only 10 years old. We moved into the home that she is still in the early 1960s, and she had the same phone number up until 3 years ago. Finally, she was getting so many intrusive, abusive, sales, threatening, scam, your grandson's in jail, go down and pick up. You know. Yep. We finally had to change her number. And, I mean, this was after having that number for 40 or 50 years, for heaven's sake.
Funny you should mention that, because my mother, who is not young at all, has had that same experience, and we're dealing with it right now. It's really invasive. I mean, here you are, you're paying for these services, and somebody potentially in a foreign country is trying to run a scam on you using your resources. So what this new act is trying to do, and where a lot of the emphasis the attorney generals and industry have been on new technologies and devices to create more transparency, to prevent spoofing in particular. That's where a robocall appears to be coming from a legitimate number when it really isn't. It may appear to be coming from a local number when it isn't.
Right.
One of the specific scams that this is addressing is the so-called one-ring scam, where the robocall rings once and then hangs up, and it appears to be, you know, an American number, but when you dial it back, you're really connecting to some long-distance number and get charged a sizable fee for just returning the phone call. So part of this bill is to require the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, to create a working group, interagency working group, to find technical solutions. And some of those are being developed by industry. There's something called the Stir-Shaken Protocol, which is a way of communicating all the steps along the line from one phone, from the caller to the ultimate recipient of the call. Those are some of the things we're trying to do about it.
I certainly appreciate you joining us here at KSL. We're going to talk with Ben McAdams about the actual legislation next. And, David, thank you so much for joining us. Give my best to everybody up there at the AG's office.
Doug, could I add just one thing? And that is,
sure,
if you think you're getting a call from a government agency asking you to pay money over the phone, that's not how we work. It's not how the IRS works. That's probably a scam.
Well, I appreciate you mentioning that.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. Really
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
We're going to take a break here at the bottom of the hour. I want to remind you that you can take KSL anywhere you go. Listen live and on demand. Download the KSL News Radio app. It's powered by Any Hour Services. Let's go ahead and take a break for our news. Ben McAdams coming up next.
The afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
After everything that unfolded this morning, it's always nice to wake up and watch that we're going to move forward with, and regardless of how you feel, this is serious. You know, sometimes it irritates me when people are just flippant about it and so on. And, you know, they're just there making their political, you know, they're counting coup, the old Native American of just kind of showing how brave you are. You're not really doing any good. You're not really doing any damage. You're just out there to show everybody how gutsy you are. And, you know, I'm honestly getting fed up with it. This is serious business. And I, for one, would actually like to know the truth. And so this morning when I saw the Speaker of the House announce that, yes, indeed, articles of impeachment would be crafted, most likely there will be a vote within the next week or so. We had scheduled Ben McAdams to join us, our 4th District Congressman, to talk about the illegal robocalls, some of the things that are happening not only in the House but in the Senate as well. We talked with the Attorney General's office just a few moments ago. But, Ben, I kind of hate to do this to you, but there's an elephant in the room. I'd like to get it off the deck as soon as possible so we can talk about this other issue. But what... how is this affecting your Democratic caucus back in Washington, D.C.? How is this affecting you, and what are you hearing in the Democratic cloakroom right now? Where is this all going?
Well, Doug, and thank you for the chance to talk about it. I have to say, so I'm on the Financial Services Committee, which is banking and finance and stuff, and I'm on the Science and Technology Committee. So I would say my day-to-day life, I get more from people back in Utah who call to tell me what they've seen on this stuff, and I'm getting really firsthand. So, but look, I think we were all expecting that articles of impeachment would come forward, and now the announcement today is that it will come forward, and these are essentially the charging documents that will be presented to the House, and then the Senate would determine whether or not to remove the president. I still am where I am all along. I'm going to look at the evidence. I think it's important to get the evidence, to bring it forward, to look at it and make a decision. I'm not going to prejudge what my position will be on articles of impeachment. They haven't been drafted yet. I'm going to read them. Where I am, Doug, is I am really honestly disgusted at both parties right now. I've got to say I'm as frustrated as anyone about how this process has played out. It's far too many theatrics from my colleagues, really colleagues on both sides of the aisle, is really disappointing to me. I think the behavior of some of the Democrats have been too gleeful about this all along. This is a constitutional crisis that we find ourselves in, but some people seem gleeful about it, and they're reflexively oppose anything the president does. At the same time, you've seen people on the other side who have ridiculed the testimony of lifelong public servants who are coming forward to give information that is really important, and we should be taking this duty very seriously to look at the information that comes forward, to examine closely the allegations around the president's behavior. Those allegations are really troubling.
Yeah,
and for me, I think that we deserve to understand them and get to the bottom of them, but to do that with seriousness that the founders have tasked us to do, not gleefully, not some partisan sideshow that both sides have put the country through over the last several months.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And sometimes there's a liability having been around a while and actually seen all this before. Second verse, same as the first, except everybody's wearing the different shoes on this one. And you look back at the Republicans' attempt on Bill Clinton, and it was as partisan as could be. Ultimately, Speaker Gingrich paid a very high price for that. And, you know, the same arguments I heard from Republicans, I'm hearing Republicans being absolutely aghast that now, since a Democrat is saying it, could possibly say something that irresponsible. And like you, I too am extremely disappointed in this. I am no fan of our president. I've been open about that. I am deeply troubled by Donald Trump. I'm not yet convinced beyond a doubt, and maybe we need to take it to the Senate for the trial in order to figure that out. But if somebody put a gun to my head today and said, you have to, absolutely, but you have to be really sure, is Donald Trump, you know, responsible for an impeachable and convictable offense, that would be an agonizing decision, because I want to be fair and I have yet to be absolutely, beyond a doubt, convinced. So I just wonder how many of your colleagues back there, our representatives, not just your Democratic colleagues, but Republican colleagues, are really considering the truth of this versus the political gain of this.
Yeah, and you know, some of my colleagues have been ready to impeach him for off-color tweets that he sends, which is, I don't endorse his Twitter activity, but that's not an impeachable offense. It may be offensive, but it's not impeachable. And other people on the other side, there's nothing he can do that they will hold him accountable for. And so it's really troubling, I think. Both parties, by and large, have very little credibility in the eyes of the public to go into this. Now, it looks like we are moving forward, and I'm going to have to make a decision. I am troubled by the president's behavior. I think it sets a dangerous precedent for the future, where we are inviting a foreign power to sometimes even asking or strong arming a foreign power to intervene in our election. That is really troubling to me. I want to sit down with the evidence and make a decision. I also haven't decided where I would come out on this. I do want to express some displeasure at the president's behavior. It warrants calling out and saying that this is not acceptable behavior from a president of ours. I would love to see whatever happens be bipartisan. But short of that, Doug, I think it's also important to note that we are continuing to move forward with work. And that's one of the things that inspires me about my service here is as a member of the Financial Services Committee. Impeachment is very divisive, but I'm working with colleagues on legislation that we are passing and moving forward. I passed a bill through the House of Representatives last week that was worked closely with a Republican on that legislation. We were champions of that, and we passed it through the House to prevent financial fraud and to help victims recover from financial fraud. We passed this robocall bill yesterday with overwhelmingly bipartisan support. So some things are happening. I'm really pretty disgusted with the behavior of both parties, but I think they've dragged the country through a mess that's really pretty divisive and going to leave some scars for the long term. And it's frustrating to me that we can't. I look at the way that we handled it when I was mayor and when I was in the state senate. We have our disagreements. Democrats and Republicans will disagree about things, but it is never at the expense of our duties. We will never put party in front of the interests of our state or the interests of the country. And I'm just afraid that too many people back here have done that they're putting party, whether it's Republican or Democratic Party, they're putting the interests of their party ahead of the duty that they owe to the Constitution and to this country. And whatever decision I make, I'm going to do it thoughtfully and carefully, weighing the facts and evidence, and then make a decision whether the president's behavior that I think is wrong, does it rise to the level of impeachment? And ultimately, Doug, I think we also kind of know where this is heading, and that is that the momentum seems to be that articles of impeachment will come to the House and probably pass and not really go anywhere in the Senate. So at some level, I think it's also worth recognizing that this vote will be largely symbolic.
It has been troubling to me, Ben, as I've listened to a lot of the testimony and the comments and so on. But when even those who allegedly are there to support you are saying, no, I didn't vote for him, no, basically I don't like him, and yes, what he did was clearly out of bounds, yes, this was really unacceptable, yes, this is extremely sketchy, but probably not impeachable. I mean, the people that are saying that are his friends.
Yeah.
That's a kind of a dubious category to be in. And Ben, I don't mean to nail you down on something you're uncomfortable in saying at this point, but Representative Colin Peterson is one of two House Democrats who have voted against different things and now are concerned. And when you look at their districts, you kind of understand why. If you're looking at it just, I want to be reelected. At this point, do you have any inclination? I know you're still weighing it. I know, but usually the scales are beginning to tilt. Have they tilted in a particular and I won't hold you to the vote ultimately, but are they tipping in a particular direction?
Well, and I appreciate you asking that. I am totally, you're not putting me in a bad spot at all. I want people to understand my process and thinking through this. And authentically, I don't know. I was telling my wife just this morning that I think what I've got are two really bad options. One option is to do nothing. And I think the president's behavior is wrong. And we need to make that statement for the record and for history and for future presidents to say that that behavior is not acceptable. And so I've got one option to do nothing and to let that behavior just fly. I've got another option that I think further divides the country, stokes these flames of partisanship and divisiveness, all for really nothing, all for something that's never going to even really see much of the light of day in the Senate. And I think we got two bad options, and it's really unfortunate. And I don't see a good option for the country to move forward. And it's with those two options that I've really got to do the same analysis that you're telling me you're doing too, is decide, you know, what do we do? Do we send a symbolic message by voting for impeachment that this behavior is not acceptable, or do we, ultimately, I think it's important that whatever happens, whatever vote happens in the coming week, that the sun's going to come up the next day, that we there's got to be a time where we start healing. And that's why I am supportive of whatever's going to happen. Get it done soon. And then there's a new day and a new year. And let's start working together for the good of the country to tackle some of the tough challenges we have. When I am home in Utah, and I'm home every weekend, I talk to people and what they're talking about is not impeachment. It's not the first thing on their mind. They're talking about the cost of prescription drugs. They're talking about our air quality. They're talking about the suicide epidemic that we see in Utah. And so I think what people want is for this three-ring circus in Washington to just end, however it's going to end, and let's move on to work. Remember, we are all on the same team. We are all Americans. We may have different points of view and different perspectives, but we're all on the same team. Let's come together and tackle some of the tough challenges that we're facing as a country.
Let's talk about this robocall bill that you and others have been working on, and I was given some of the numbers when we were talking with the Attorney General's office. Is it true the Senate voted on this 97-1? I mean, how many times do you hear about that? What is this bill going to do, and will the president sign it?
So the president has indicated that he will sign it. This is legislation that allows the Federal Communications Commission to fine robocall spoofing. So spoofing is where, you know, you see that number coming from an 801 area code, and so you pick it up and turns out that it's some, you know, scam or some advertisement. And so it's going to allow the FCC to fine violators up to $10,000 per violation, even more if it's an intentional violation. So it really goes after these robocalls. It's, you know, to be candid, it's not going to solve everything. We see some of these calls that are coming from overseas, some of these scams from overseas. At some point, it's going to be hard to stop everyone, but hopefully it'll cut down on so many of these. It gives the FCC the tools that they need to really go after some of the violators who are blowing up my phone. And I hear from so many people, you know, I don't even answer my phone anymore if it's from a number that I don't recognize, because it's likely one of these robocalls. And so the bill has passed the House, passed the Senate. It really gives the tools to the FCC, working with the Federal Trade Commission, to go out and enforce this and then start gathering. Let's understand what's still happening, what violations are still out there, and how can we further crack down on it. But it really is my hope that this gives tools to the FCC that they need to stop it, to crack down on it. It really has blown up in the last few years, and hopefully we now have the tools to put an end to it, or at least to reduce it.
I hope so. This morning, as I was watching, you know, the proceedings unfolding, I had at least two. Just while I was sitting there, I have no idea in the course of a day, because they usually hang up, obviously, before it can go to an answer machine. But, Ben, if this really works, I'm going to get many, many fewer callers from Midvale, Utah, and American Fork, Utah, for scams. Those, for some reason, that's, and occasionally I'll get a Midway, and we have ties to Midway, so I tend to answer those, and I get scammed every time. So I appreciate what you're doing.
Well, thank you. It's for me, it's just rewarding too to see some things happening on a bipartisan level. I hope maybe we're learning the muscle memory, refiguring out how to do this, but there's some things that slip through that are good and bipartisan, and let's hope we can get back to more of that.
Ben, I hope you have a great holiday season. Give my best to your family, okay?
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you so much. Ben McAdams. Ben happens to be my representative in the 4th Congressional District here in the state of Utah. By the way, any comments on the show, we always love to get them on the Utah Community Credit Union KSL text line at 57500. We have some texts that have come in the last little while, and I'll share some of them if we have time before the top of the hour. So stay with us. A little bit more to come here at KSL News Radio on this show. Thank you for joining us.
afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
You know, it is interesting, and I absolutely agree with Rob Bishop in our conversation. I was rattling off some of the statistics that at this point in the inquiry with Bill Clinton, only 29% of the American people wanted him impeached. At this point in the inquiry with Richard Nixon, it was 38%. At this point in the inquiry with Trump, it is 44%. And it was interesting. Rob said, boy, I hope that, you know, we're not impeaching somebody on the poll numbers and so on. And one of the reasons I'm bringing this up right here and right now is because others are bringing it up, including the President of the United States of America, which earlier today with Dave and Debbie, Congressman Chris Stewart alluded to. I think, okay, apparently we don't have that sound. I apologize for that. I thought we had that up and ready to go. But Chris, at the end of his comments on the impeachment proceedings, which was pretty boilerplate, well, I think we've got it now. Here we go.
This is the fastest and the flimsiest and the weakest base of impeachment in our history. And it's happened in a fraction of the time that other proceedings did. There was no special counsel. There was no, you know, none of the process that supported other impeachments. And I think the answer to that question, again, why the rush? And it's this, Debbie. And I said this in one of the first open hearings that we held on the Intelligence Committee a few weeks ago. I said, I think the longer this goes on, the less the American people will support it, and the polling is showing that that's true. And I think that the Democratic leadership knows that that's true.
Okay, the polling is showing that that's true. You know, I was curious about that because I'd been hearing things to the contrary, and we scoured it. We really did. And basically 538, many other polling organizations or people that keep track of the polls, right now it's 47% support impeachment, 44% do not, 57% think that the President Trump committed impeachable offenses. And by the way, in so many polls, they're saying what has happened is that people haven't changed their opinions. They have only changed their commitment, because these numbers are identical to the numbers that came out in mid-November. So they're more convinced of their original position. But I thought, okay, and we dug deeper and deeper and deeper, and finally, from CourthouseNews.com, we found the story. Poll finds public support for impeachment waning. The Morning Consult political poll indicated, released Wednesday, found 47% of voters believe the House of Representatives should vote to impeach the president, down 4 points from October. Meanwhile, 43% of voters say Trump should not be impeached. That is the only source that we could find. Everything else pretty much shows that everything is status quo, and the only difference is people have entrenched themselves just a little deeper into what they already felt. But as long as we're talking about some numbers, it was interesting because we worked on this morning as we were preparing the show. You know, during the Clinton impeachment process, and he was indeed impeached, not convicted, but he had a 70% approval rating when the House approved the two articles of impeachment, and 63% when the Senate rejected those impeachment articles. President Clinton's popularity never went below 60%. Huh, interesting if you're looking at statistics. Thanks for joining us.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.